is we want more than they want to give us. And it's going to be always going to be that way.
This is take four, the interview with Ed Young and Don Smith. Well, let's turn to the regents then, also, which is a subject having to do with the legislature. I guess to begin with, how much did Pat Lucy discuss, consult with you on his regent appointments?
Two or three times. But it was very confidential, and I didn't go around telling people this, you know. Pat and I were always on very good terms. Mm-hmm. We basically disagreed on almost everything, but we were on good personal terms. Mm-hmm. I never had to wait 24 hours to get into his office if he was in town. I liked him personally, respected his brains. I thought he was, his policies were, I thought he'd gotten carried. He's got this Kennedy business. Anything the Kennedys do, he has to do it. And that, I think that just bringing in bright young men who've been to Eastern universities to run the state without any knowledge, that was one of the things that got us into some of our troubles.
But did he follow your advice on regent appointments? Because they used to do that, apparently.
I remember one, and afterwards he's saying, well, he's your regent, you wanted him.
Who's that?
I don't know this.
You don't know this story?
Arthur? Yeah,
yes, Arthur. We wanted him reappointed, because we needed somebody who would speak up for faculty. Now, Arthur, of course, overdid it, but you never get anybody that's perfect, you know. But he was a balance for some of the others, and turned out sometimes it was kind of fun, and sometimes it was pretty disastrous.
Yes, but through the Regents report, that he's very visible.
He was on balance. Arthur's a good Regent. In the some of the issues that really count to a university very deeply. Mm-hmm. You couldn't ask for a stronger voice.
Yeah, he was a strong voice for faculty difference, governance, for instance.
Yes.
That's terribly important. But he did have one, I think, this. He would look at an issue, and he would either say, if he wasn't very interested, that's something that should be left up to the administration and the faculty, we shouldn't do that. And if it turned out to be something that the administration and faculty was doing that was interesting, he'd say, that's a policy issue, and the regents should do it. But that we all have our foibles.
Yeah. Now, did you talk to him, to DeBart Lehman, by phone? Did you say, look, Arthur, we want you to do this?
Very rarely. I was very loath to lobby individual. I could have done it once or twice. But a great deal on, unless they were chairman of a committee and something was coming up where I wanted to explain it. See, I perceived, and I may have been wrong, that part of Fred Harrington's problem was he got too cozy with a couple of regents, and they, including DeBart Lehman, was one of them, and they sort of ran things, and that alienated the others. And I guess I talked to regents when it seemed important to do so, but I try to be very careful not to have one any particular regents that are dependent. There were some I liked a lot better than others. But.
Well, how were Lucy's appointments?
Mixed. Mm-hmm. Well, you see, he appointed people like Beckwith and Girard.
Yes.
They're different. One was a Republican. And he appointed him because he had been so successful as chairman of the state fair. Lucy told me this himself. State fair that they reorganized, and the state fair was a failing proposition, got it back on its feet, and he'd done it so well that he admired Beckwith, and he was a Republican, and he appointed him to the regents. Bill Girard was the man who raised money for his campaign. He appointed him because he raised money for him.
Well, which was the good one?
Beckwith was a very, very good regent.
That's what I thought from looking at the minutes.
Yeah, he was in fact, Lucy made, as Ed says, some good appointments. Let me make a caveat on your comment that he consulted with you. I know he did, but he did not consult with anybody in system administration on any of the regents. And that I found strange, because in when I was at Minnesota, whenever there was a regent being appointed, the governor always conferred with the president and the vice presidents about a list of names. They were elected by a caucus up there, a legislative caucus, but the governor was influential in X number of cases, and the governor would always meet, and usually the man who was going to head the caucus, whatever it would be a joint caucus for a legislative district, and whatever majority party was, their most prestigious person would be the head of the caucus. That person would usually confer with the president of the university and with the vice presidents. So it was very commonplace. I always expected to get a call when there was a regent's vacancy, that somebody in the governor's office would call up and say, "Would you come down? We've got a list of people who are under consideration."
Now, what I don't know whether, you see, what went on before Lucy, because Lucy was a tremendous break in every way with past and practice. Knowles would have been inclined to have done that. The only way you find out is to talk to Ira Baldwin.
Well, I've been told that in fact they usually did consult with the president, the governors.
Yeah, that would be my impression earlier on. Particularly Warren Knowles was a very special person. In being extraordinarily thoughtful of people and considerate. Whether how far back that went, I don't know. I suppose it varied. I can imagine when La Follette was rigging the regents to fire the president, he probably didn't consult with the president much. Do you think?
That's true. Yeah, I'm sure that he didn't. The other, I think incidentally the years I spent over in system. We were unusually fortunate in the board that we had to work with. And the board I had to work with in Minnesota was equally good. I don't believe anybody was ever more blessed in two universities with the good boards of regents. Now, that doesn't mean that every region on either board was a comfort. But it does mean that there were extraordinarily able people.
So you thought that Dreyfus's appointments were good too?
Well, Dreyfus, I was leaving at that particular time. Who did Dreyfus appoint? I was trying to.
Well, I didn't know.
Oh, I don't recall. No, I was really talking about the. The people I would particularly single out would be the chairman of the education committee, which I had to work with all the time, and also the chairman of the board. The first three presidents of the board under the system, I don't think could have been better selected. Roy Kopp was ideal to try to merge two unlike boards. The Jack Pelosek and Bert McNamara were two of the finest board presidents that one could imagine.
Is the president's position on the board, it's very much sought after, I know. Is it very influential? Makes a big difference?
Yeah, particularly if it's a good person running it.
Because they almost set the agenda in a way, and how the thing goes, and directing the questions, getting people involved. Ben Lawton came down here two or three times a week from Marshfield because of things coming up. Learned it. Now, if the president of the board thinks all he has to do is preside, then he isn't as influential. He has to know what's going on, know who cares, and know how to steer things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in part, he's responsible for carrying out the administration agenda, getting it through.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have a good working relationship with the chairman if you're going to get your agenda.
Grover, was he president of the board when you were still?
He became president. He had just been elected the time I was leaving, and Mr. Grover was not a useful member of the board, and I think he's still not. And I'm pleased that I didn't have to work with him. That Bob O'Neill had that pleasure, which I don't think was much of a pleasure for him, of having him as his board president.
Grover was Dreyfus's appointment, presumably?
No, he was ex officio.
Oh, that's right, yes.
He was first appointed by, he was appointed before he became...
He used it as a platform to run.
And then he used the Regents as a platform to run for state office,
That gets into the question of Dreyfus. Do you want to talk about that, the controversy over when Dreyfus started running to be governor?
Well, there wasn't much controversy. What he did was he asked to stay on the payroll and get paid, and I wouldn't let him because it was improper. And he said, well, the governor's getting paid and he's running, and that, therefore I should, but, you know, it was just simple. I said no. And then, you know, it just seemed to me... If I'd done it, I would have been chastised by every legislator and probably been pulled up before the courts or something. Somebody could have sued.
And the Regents, how did they feel about it?
They backed me. But see, I did it and then told the Regents. I didn't ask them.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the way it was?
Yes, they had an executive session on it because there were two or three Regents that did not agree.
No, they wanted to.
They were people who wanted... were very much fascinated in the political game, and they wanted to...
And then one of them said to me, well, he may be governor.
I said,
yeah, that's a risk we run, isn't it? Something
but,
like that.
They thought it was bad politics to offend a man who might wind up winning the governorship. But no, the rest of them were very solid.
Mm-hmm. Well, were you at all influenced by that possibility, or did you think he wouldn't be elected?
I didn't think about that at all. I only thought, is it appropriate for me to keep on the payroll a man who's running for governor full time. He'd been running, for a year or part time in the evenings, that was his business in a way. You lean over backwards. But when he's going to leave the office, put somebody else in charge, and get paid, I didn't have authority to pay. I could have then put every politician that was running on the state on the payroll for the same reason. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make any sense to do that. Nobody ever had done that before, and I wasn't going to start that. No, it had nothing to do with whether you're going to win or not. I didn't expect him to win, but that didn't make any difference to me. There was always a little strain between Dreyfus and me.
A little strain?
No, just a little.
I've heard it was very serious.
About what?
Well, somebody said that you couldn't even go downtown, the two of you, and talk to Dreyfus.
Oh, yes, I used to go to his office and talk to him.
You did?
Yeah.
See, well, that's what oral history is for, to correct all these.
Well, yeah. Or else find that I'm a liar. Cheat.
So you did?
Sure.
Well, where did he get this come from?
Well, people imagine a great deal. In the first place, see, he wasn't governor long before I retired from the presidency.
Yeah.
So there was only a short time. But in that time, I was in his office a number of times.
Mm. And you say there was a little bit of strain.
Oh, yes. Well, I think it came about in this fashion, that I never took him very seriously, and that offended the hell out of him. I just never treated him... we had to listen to him so much in the chancellor's meetings. He had always full of ideas. Then he got to be, we rotated the chairmanship, and he had a big agenda. He was going to do a lot of things. this group was organized originally to fight the act as a collective bargaining almost group with the director of the old state university. And so it was carried forward into the system.
The chancellors would meet. Okay. Yeah.
And they apparently had a fair amount of influence. But the system had changed so much, there wasn't much to do. We'd meet and we'd listen to the president explain, or his staff, what they've been doing, what they're up to. And we very rarely did we differ with the administration. If we did, most of us would do it privately anyway. But Lee wanted to make something of that. Well, I kind of poo-pooed it, you know. I didn't say you couldn't do it, he said, Mr. Chairman. But when he'd say, well, how often should we meet? I'd say something like, well, not very often, should we? Or something. Not unless we have something. I'd needle him a little bit. I'd known him a long time. He worked for me when I was dean, you know.
Yes, I suppose so.
Yeah. And he's a very bright guy. But he wasn't interested in doing anything. He was interested in talking about it, campaigning. Obviously I must have been wrong not to take him seriously, but he wasn't the most outstanding governor we ever had.
He was, Lee was an interesting personality. He was a man who, I think was driven by an overpowering. He was a very bright man, driven by a great ambition. I've never quite understood what made Lee run, but he was constantly looking at a bigger job. He loved the public spotlight. He was fascinated with the uses of the platform. He was very much uninterested in the details of policy and management. He was not as a chancellor, he was a very, very difficult man to work with, although always a sort of entertaining man in lots of ways. I think he did some things that, if I understood the history of Stevens Point, which were quite constructive and useful to that institution at various times, simply by the sort of panache and presence that he had in the way of building up enthusiasm. But always had his mind on the next higher job. And I
wanted to be president of the system at one stage, you know.
He did want to be president. In fact, he thought he should be. He also...
I became president.
When Ed became president, he wanted to. And
Was he on the list? Was he on the list?
No, he was nominated, but I think he made another push at it when O'Neill came in. Mm-hmm. But he also made a big push at becoming chairman of the FCC and a big push in becoming Secretary of Defense. He had all sorts of dreams of glory in Washington at various times.
How was he for the university?
He was almost useless. It wasn't that he intended to do us any damage, but he was never in. He really wasn't in charge of policy.
He had Lindner as his administrative person, and Lindner had seemed to have either wanted to lean over backwards to prove he wasn't for the university or something, because they supported this business about the personnel stuff, and he was this Hansen woman worked for him, and didn't she?
Yeah, and Doris Hansen.
And she was pushing that kind of stuff. She didn't understand it, but she was pushing it because of power. It was
I would say not a particularly good era. His budgets weren't all that bad. They weren't very good, and they weren't very thoughtful, and he didn't fight very effectively for them, but they weren't that bad. But then his budgets were always fell apart before they ever got put together. That is, they'd be passed, and then within 3 months there'd be a deficit or something, and then there'd be a an improvised cut. It was a very chaotic period.
Remember,
fiscally.
He campaigned that the surplus has been taken from the people and should be given back to them. You got a check, that kind of stuff. Which you, of course, put in anybody that knew anything about income tax base, it was crazy as hell. But he was a showman. He was really a very good showman, but also a very bright person. That is, maybe it was unfair, but I used to characterize him as somebody who heard himself talking and thought it was pretty, that's where he got his, he heard himself and then he believed it. Well, all of us are somewhat that way, but he was a little more so.
When I go ahead.
Well, just did he? Somebody said he gave flexibility to the university.
Oh no!
Salary.
Didn't he put the cap back on? Nobody could have a salary as high as the governor's.
He didn't give us that flexibility. He also we'd get a 6% salary increase, and then it would be by executive order reduced to 4% because they were in a deficit situation. No. His budgets were chaotic as far as trying to manage the university was concerned, or the system. Mm-hmm. No, and as far as flexibility was concerned, we really had thought that through Kenny Linder we could get some, but he turned his affairs over to Doris Hansen and to this guy Howard, both of whom were total
bureaucrats.
Sometimes you could get a little relief, but not very much. I don't think he was ill-intentioned. It was just that he wanted to be successful in a job he didn't understand very well. I believe that was his problem.
This is
Linder, yeah. And Dreyfus was really always working on the public front. It wasn't a matter of not being accessible.
No, it wasn't any problem. Mm-hmm. No, and we never really had any, we never exchanged any words of any kind. So
he did have one strange symbolic thing.
What was that?
I don't know whether you remember it or not, or maybe it didn't seem to bother you at the time, which I thought was exactly the right response, because, well, he had a budget hearing. And I was not unaccustomed to going into the governor's office, being called to go into the governor's office and discuss the governor's budget. And then the very first budget of the system, I know Pat Lucy did have a public hearing on the budget, and that was a sort of a disaster. I was just an observer at that, but it was that kind of strange meeting. I don't think he ever repeated it. And with the rest of the time with Lucy and with Schreiber, it had always been a gathering in the governor's office to give us a sort of last shot at his budget, which in the case of Lucy was totally ineffective, but nevertheless it was kind of polite. Well, Dreyfus had this strange set of budget hearings, which he never attended. And then we got word that he was going to have a hearing.
No, I don't.
Yeah, well, we went down to the hearing. Yeah, he was going to have a governor's hearing. And he put it in a great big room, that top conference room, which has a very high platform. He sat up.
Oh, yes, yeah. I remember now.
And then there's a desk that sits about 18 feet below that. And with a microphone, and the two of us were called up to that desk with the microphone, and Lee is sitting up there all alone, you see, with, I guess he had a secretary with him.
Well, you see, that sort of thing didn't bother me any, because I had enough, my feeling about the whole thing was such that I wouldn't pay much attention to that.
Yeah.
I thought I could hold my own with Lee.
Well, it turned out to be sort of a disaster. It was a very boring thing. Ed thought of that. It was, you know, he'd ask Ed a question, Ed would spin out an answer, you know, very cheerfully, and it'd be a sort of a mean question, so-called. And was extremely cordial about it. Lee finally got tired and adjourned the meeting, and there was hardly. The minute I saw the setup, that was the first thing I thought of. Well, he's going to get his pint of blood.
I wasn't so concerned. I'm reconstructing. That room was always arranged that way, wasn't it?
It was that way, but no governor had ever met with the people in that room.
Part of it, he wanted to be treated differently because on the salary thing, for instance, he didn't wanted anybody in the state service to get paid as much as he did by $1.
Yeah.
that's awkward when you see, that's why the salaries got sort of whack at the, around here. Didn't affect me very much because I was leaving and so it didn't make much difference to me, but when they went to get some replacement, then it made a difference.
Did you feel that the Board of Regents changed or became less effective from after 1970 and into the 1980s?
It did, because I think in one respect they didn't know where they were coming from. The old board knew what the university was. It worked for the University of Wisconsin, even though it had expanded. And the other board worked for the state under the direction of
Gene McPhee.
Gene McPhee, who was a very able man. See, Gene McPhee had the power, but he didn't want any trappings. He had the title director, but he ran that thing like that. And he had his board with him. And so those regents knew what they were supposed to do. They each were assigned to a campus,
yes,
and they represented that campus. When they come together in the system, we had Walter Renko used to turn to me and say, "Ed, now what do we do at our university?"
Yeah.
Walter, by the way, was a good regent.
What?
Yes.
Uh-huh. See, the first.
But you say, then what happened?
They didn't exactly know what. See, some of them had come from the ones that came from the other side, because it would merge the two boards. They thought of themselves as representatives of campuses, by and large, whereas our people had already represented Milwaukee and Green Bay, Parkside, the Center System, and that they weren't picked from location. They were picked for the university. So
they were picked for their stature.
Yes.
This is a leading question. I mean, isn't that what changed?
Partly what has happened, and that's happened everywhere in appointive boards, and it's even it's a problem in committee structures, is that we have moved into an era of constituency representation. Now, what does that mean? That means that at one time, boards were selected because of the ability of the person, and in the case of the old WSU board, they were also viceroys. They were people from that particular area. There was a little constituency representation, I think, in the earlier Minnesota and Wisconsin boards, as represented by the fact that it was sort of good form in such states that somebody be associated with agriculture.
Yeah.
In a way, and somebody be associated with labor in a way, and somebody be associated with business, but that would take only three out of the board and so on. Well, then we have to have a minority. It has to be, so it's, a board isn't right unless it's got somebody who's black. It's got to have a woman.
More than one.
And, well, that's the first step, and then the next step is, but that's token representation. So you've got to have several women, and it's a little bit tokenism if you don't have more than one minority. So then you've got the Hispanics as another minority.
And the governors just bought all of this.
Well, they're kind of pushed into it by
some of them go easier than others. Now, well, Earl, for Earl, he just lapped it up because the thing that he has been made a great deal of, helping what he felt were the disadvantaged groups. And you can't, you don't fault him for that, but you might not be, the people who happen to fit the category and who happen to support his campaign might not be the ablest people in the state. It's just possible.
Yeah. So I think I think there is a question of whether or not you can sustain.
See how many different kinds of
representation
your board have. Obviously, it's important that there be minorities represented and that women be there. But of course, my own view is that there's been discrimination against women. But if they don't discriminate against them, they'll turn up there because of their quality. You know, there's no.
Was Joyce Erdman a good region?
Sometimes crazy.
What was she crazy about?
Oh, she'd come in and start saying, with some idea she'd gotten picked up somewhere at a cocktail party and start pushing it. But she was devoted to the university, and I would say she was a good regent.
Yeah, on balance, I think she was a very good regent. Yeah, but
you know, you asked me what she was like.
She'd suddenly take off on a tangent,
yeah. I see that she was very opposed to the vet school, but it's...
Well, that's nothing. I mean, a lot of people were opposed to that. Yeah. You know, we took the view all the way along that we didn't want it unless they appropriated money for it. And it was done by the legislature.
Yes.
The regents said, where some of the regents, other regents were opposed to it.
Yes. No, the regents don't seem to be very certain about how to deal with downtown. The interview the other night, they said the regents didn't come down very much or didn't do as much lobbying as they did. Did you think that?
Well, that's one of the problems we had, is that most of our regents didn't go downtown. Two or three went down a good deal.
Lawton did.
Well, and Gerard did, and
John Levine did.
John Levine did a great deal of that.
Mm-hmm. Was but you don't, glad they did or not? I mean, Gerard.
Well, you never knew what their agenda was. Lawton, you knew where he was going, but the others, you never knew what Gerard's agenda. We used to have Charles Steiger, lovely, sweet old man, but he'd vote for the budget up here and then go downtown and say it was too much. Because he was a conservative Republican. But he's a very fine man, and he's dead, and I shouldn't tell you this. But this is the sort of thing some of them did. Charlie Gillette, you never knew where he was at. And he was a very bright guy. Regent for more than 24 years.
What they're missing is the fact that historically, it was the increasing power and interference of the legislature. The fact that they were writing all kinds of policies, they were getting into legislative oversight of everything under the sun, they were diminishing the importance of the regents.
Okay, that's a good point.
Yeah, in other words, has been the most critical factor, is not that the quality of the boards has deteriorated, but the fact that the respect paid to the board by the government has deteriorated.
You see, now this collective bargaining bill, they'll have them bargaining with the faculty, with the Department of Employee Relations, and Joker, it just wipes out. Personnel is what the university is all about.
But still, we're spared that for 4 years now.
We are, but that's the attitude downtown.
Yeah.
Well, some of them have said to me, by God, this will give us a chance to get a hold of that place. You see, some of them were aware of this, but we have some regions who just vote for collective bargaining because the labor people, they can't bring themselves, no matter what they tell you privately, to vote the other way. Except McNamara didn't vote for it.
Much of this came after my time, although not all of it, because he was also active even before he became board president. No regent, in all my 18 years in two states, ever spent as much time as aggressively and as well-informed as Dave Beckwith. And he knew what he was doing, and he knew the policies, and he was articulate, and he was blunt. And his reward for it was not to get reappointed to the board at the first opportunity.
That was Dreyfus's doing, because he said in order to get Ben Lawton reappointed, he'd have to appoint Gerard, which was just sheer nonsense.
Why?
Because Gerard was a Democrat, and the legislature, the Senate wouldn't approve but another. Beckwith would have gotten approved quicker than Gerard, if anything.
Mm.
Dreyfus was
Lawton being a Democrat, he had to appoint a Republican? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'd have to point another, he said another Democrat, because Beckwith was a Republican. And he wanted to be sure to get Lawton approved. Mm. It was back, he was thinking, you know.
Tony Earle was the one that did not reappoint Beckwith, I believe.
Was it Tony Earle?
I'm not quite sure when he went off the board.
No.
But in any event, he did not get reappointed, even though he'd. So you see, people are saying that the board isn't very active. On the other hand, the government is enormously active. And then
we used to have much more continuity on the regents. For years and years, the Republican governors would always reappoint a Democrat, the publisher from Sheboygan, Matt Werner. Well, after a while they said he was a token Democrat, but there was continuity. The people did a good job, they got reappointed. Now it's looked upon as much more as political patronage. Although, I must say, when I first came here, Mr. Fred in 1950 had a very difficult board. Sensenbrenner was the chairman, and he was trying to run things, and we had Campbell, who was very reactionary, and so on. So Mr. Fred worked very hard at that, to keep those guys from doing something. Mm-hmm. And he had the McCarthy period, and we got through that without getting hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But so we had some, there have been some ups and downs. I think you're right, we had a very good group of regents about the time you came here.
Yeah, they were. They had a very difficult job. They were trying to blend two totally different traditions of mm-hmm. the functions of the board.
Mm-hmm. And there was a good group of regents when Connie Elvium became president, because I was chairman of the committee to nominate, so I spent a lot of time with the regents, because it was done differently in those days, and by and large. And then there was a good group that selected John Weaver. They had a notion that the legislature was Republican, that if they could find a Republican to be could get along with the legislature. Well, it wasn't a terribly good notion, but because the election went the other way.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes, well, Pulisic commented that it used to be the most coveted position in the state,
yeah.
and no longer was, because the board didn't have power.
I think the board's capacity to influence, to control, or to be publicly influential in relationship to the university has been diminished by the activity of government.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and by the quality of some of the appointments.
Yeah, as well.
Now, mm-hmm. Even some that people that like Sensenbrenner I didn't agree with about things, but he was a powerful person in the state. He was an important person.
That's right. They had a constituency, and people, legislators, didn't get tangled with him.
And then with Cleary at one time, the judge was very, you know, these are important people. They made a difference.
What did you think of Lawton as a regent?
Well, I think he worked very, very hard at it. I think that he was a man of great principle, but I think he sometimes thought if the Democrats wanted it, it must be right. But that would be the only thing that I would say. Now, that doesn't mean that he and I agreed, because I never agreed with any of the, we had a good relationship, and that I could disagree with on one thing and agree on something else, most of them. But I thought Ben worked as hard as anybody could, didn't he?
He did. He was, I was favored with a number of good presidents of the, or chairman of the Education Committee, when Ben was a chairman with whom he worked hard, he knew the agenda, he would always come down to confer with me about the agenda the day before or the night before. He was supportive, he loved the university. Now, the one thing I would say that sometimes in the full board meetings I wasn't in agreement with what he was doing, he is a man that believes in something that you may have gathered I'm not so fond of. Namely, that virtue ultimately rests in government, that is, in the voice of the people as it's expressed through their elected representatives. He's a very, very strong Democrat, staunch Democrat, long-term Democrat, and I thought as a regent he was much too attentive to what it was that the governor and the political leaders were telling him, that he didn't want to get at cross purposes with the
He had a very close pipeline. You know, his brother, John, he was one of the probably the most successful lobbyists in the state, and has been for years. And I'm quite Democrat, represents the labor people, very, very skillfully. He's extremely intelligent, but so, you know, but so he would get the Democratic side of things pretty often. But he would go and talk to the governor about things quite frequently, so the Democratic governors, and I have the same criticism. I said it a little differently, but that would be the only thing. But his devotion to the university. See, I measure people I have a couple of rules. One is, it isn't whether somebody agrees with me or disagrees with me, but whether he's working for the institution or he's working for something for himself. Mm-hmm. If he's trying to build his own career on the university or something. Ben Lawton was as devoted to the university as anybody will ever be.
Yeah, I would agree.
And Joyce is too. She's devoted to the university. Sometimes she doesn't think through before she jumps. But maybe that's matter. I happen to like her very much. I've known her since she was a student.
Yeah. Tell me about this search and screen for the academic vice president.
We must have had a committee of some kind.
Well, there was, yes.
Who was chairman of that?
Cronin, Dave Cronin.
Dave Cronin. Mm-hmm. You ought to talk to Dave.
I have. That's why I'm asking.
Well, didn't he tell you?
Yes, he did. Well, he doesn't know. His what he said was that their choice wasn't accepted, and your choice.
Oh, yeah. I guess we. Mm. Something like this, we. They presented me some names, and I showed them to the regents, and one of them said, with support from some others on the special committee, said, why don't you go back and ask them about so-and-so?
Dave Adamany, is that it?
That's right. Your memory's good.
They were after, they wanted Adamany on the list. They also had another person who was a black administrator who popped up a couple, three times. I'll be more explicit. There were three members of the Regents Committee. One was Grover, another one was Levine, and another one was Ed Hales. The real agenda, I think, was very clearly that they wanted Dave Adamany, but to get him, they had to get him on the list from the committee that Cronin chaired. He didn't get on the list.
You know, and by the way, very able person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he had made that speech attacking all the rest of the faculty, saying that he was the only one who did any teaching, and there were two or three faculty members who thought that they did too.
But that was Lucy's pressure.
What?
That Adamany was on the list because of Lucy's pressure.
Oh, sure.
On the regents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which means that Lucy was exerting pressure on the regents.
Oh, sure. Some of these regents hardly knew when they were being Democrats and when they were being regents. They thought the same.
Even though Lucy was out of power by then.
Well, yeah, but he'd appointed them.
But yeah, he'd appointed John, he'd appointed Ed Hales, and I think he appointed Grover too, didn't he? Yeah,
and then he also had, in addition to outside the committee, he had Girard, who was very close to him, you see.
Yeah.
Well, been his finance chairman. So.
But you didn't like this very well,
what?
As I understand it. This overturning of your.
Oh, well, they didn't overturn.
I was very willing to go back to the committee. I went back. I thought the regents have a right to ask if they really intended it that way. And when the committee turned out, it said they intended that they really meant what they did. I wasn't surprised at that. And so I took it back to the to the Regents Committee, and they were upset, some of them, and suggested that I invite Adam Money for an interview anyway. And I declined to do that. I said, do we have a system? We're going to follow it or not? And I just said no, and they were very upset that I would take such a high hand with them. So we...
There were two people that on the list that Ed did recommend that they be interviewed. They were interviewed. I think they'd both been very able people. In fact, one of them's had a very distinguished administrative career since. They were, by that time it was clear that the Regents were, that the members were not going to accept anybody since the committee and had been resistant to their desire to see a name.
But you said there were only three Regents were pushing for this.
This was there was a subcommittee of Regents.
Yeah, but they were a majority of the committee.
They were a majority of the subcommittee.
And they'd have to bring in a recommendation, you see. And so, and I didn't see the need. See, and it was a position that, as far as I was concerned, if we didn't fill it, it was all right with me. I was trying to slim the system down. So they, and in that sense, it played into my hands. He was doing all the work.
It didn't play into my hands. I was probably more disappointed because I thought I needed help. And he
well, Nathan, you could get help making him a vice president. Yeah. See, the word academic vice president means that they have something to, they think that means that they run the programs and tell them what to do out there. So that always bothered me a little. We had associate vice president for academic affairs. I used to catch them calling up chancellors and telling them how to run their shops. Didn't like that. So in a sense, it didn't create a crisis for me, not having, left a bad taste of these people. So the whole thing went into a closed meeting of the board, and the board soundly sustained my position.
This is the you're talking about the search.
Yeah, about refusing to bring him for an interview.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah.
But they did then appoint another.
No, they didn't.
Committee.
Oh, they appointed another committee, but never.
Or you must have.
No, I don't think so. I think about that time, or maybe Ed. I guess you did appoint another committee, but it never got off the ground.
So nothing ever happened then.
No, we
not
just left
till.
It vacant. Worked fine.
I don't agree with him that it worked fine, but nevertheless, I know what his objective was. Yes.
Did you get asked him here briefly?
Oh, no, that's
no, that was way back at the beginning.
No, I know, but I mean, somebody said that Haas was back here very briefly.
No.
I had never heard of him.
No, not that I know of. After I left, Joe Kaufman came over at some stage to help. Or did I bring him over before I left?
No, you didn't bring him over. O'Neill did.
Yeah.
After you left, then I left in July, and then he brought Joe over as sort of advisor or interim, and then. He didn't get around to replacing Joe, and finally asked Joe to become executive vice president, which he did for a time. And then,
worked out a deal with Don that I would leave the position 6 months before he did. He was planning, because of his age, to leave in June or something like that. And I left in January.
Why? Why did you work that out?
Well, we had to have somebody to carry the place,
oh,
keep the place going.
Well, why did you leave?
Why did I leave? Mm. I was illegal. I was overage.
You weren't illegal. You could stay when you're 65.
Well, but at age 62, they stopped adding anything to your retirement.
Yeah,
I lost a year out of my retirement.
I lost.
So it was
purely that, was it?
Purely?
You weren't angry at this vice presidency.
Oh, that, I was angry for the moment at that. That didn't determine whether I left or not. One of the governors thought maybe I left because of him, but it wasn't true. No, I left for my, you know, I didn't really enjoy the job very much. And I saw that what was happening, we were in I didn't see anything that could happen the next 2 years that was going to make a great deal of difference. And why just hang around? And remember another thing. In order to stay on, I would have had to appear before the regents once a year and be reappointed by them. Well, I didn't see any likelihood that I wouldn't.
What?
But each year, if you're over 62, yes, you have to come up for a re-examination. Well, I said, what the hell should I do that for? I'm losing my retirement, and why should I have to appear before the board each year to find out whether I'm fit to go on? They asked me to come in the first place.
Yeah.
But I really didn't enjoy the job terribly much.
Still, you wanted to protect Madison, and how did you know what Dreyfus might be going to do?
But there was nothing, you know, I couldn't protect Madison forever. It's going to happen sooner or later. Mm. And we got somebody in who worked to protect Madison. Mm. I had one condition when I became president, and that was that Don stay as long as I did.
Yes.
So I made a point of getting out before he died. That was one of the reasons, the whole mixture. You know, trying to remember exactly why you do things and being accurate is very difficult. Mm. There was no one thing that was overwhelming. Mm. But I just saw it going on more of the same. And another rule I think is a pretty good one is to quit when you're ahead.
Yeah, I had intended to go back to the department when a new president was appointed. Mm-hmm. And then Ed created this situation where I had the terrible agony of either having the search go on forever or seemed to be that, or else agreeing to stay on. I don't think I agreed to stay on as long as you did. I agreed to stay on for at least 2 years.
Yeah, well, the regents agreed to keep on appointing you.
Yeah, and that's right. They agreed to keep on appointing me. See, I was already over age, and it was costing me money.
So he lost out in his retirement.
But so that, in a sense, the timing on all this was sort of. Determined at the time you accepted the appointment,
yes,
and the conditions under.
Yeah,
I think Bert understood pretty well that you weren't likely to stay too long.
But I think the most important thing is I sized up the then situation. It looked as though it was going to stay the same. You know, the economy, the legislative university, the regions, everything was going to go on about the same. And at the end, the university wouldn't be better for my staying, and I'd be worse.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Wait, I want to. We're nearing the end of the tape, and I didn't bring three. Oh, why did you let Irv Shane go?
Go where?
To Washington.
I didn't let him go. He went of his own accord.
I mean, he was.
He wanted to go. He decided to go. He made the decision.
Mm.
He didn't, there's no bargaining, he didn't ask for anything. I had no choice in the matter.
Hmm. And what, did you have much to do with getting him back?
Yes.
Well, would you want to talk about that?
Well, there was a committee, and they came in with some names, and from all, as I looked at it, and as the Regents Committee looked at it, his was the most promising one. There was one other that I thought of quite seriously, and that was the man who is now head of the vet science. He was right in the middle of getting that thing going, and we didn't have anybody to replace him.
Who was that?
Easterday.
Easterday, Barney Easterday.
Mm-hmm. You know him?
No.
No.
Very able man.
Very able man. Another name on that list, I guess you can say, it was Rogotsky, wasn't it?
Yes, Bob's very able.
And he would have been a good one, but Irv had more experience, and and that somebody the regents could agree on, I could agree on. And I went out and visited with him and talked to him, and he came back.
So it wasn't a foregone conclusion that you would get him back?
Oh, no. When he left here, he didn't intend to come back. Mm. Now he intends to come back. Yes, he says it to tell you anybody that he's going to be back in 4 years.
Back to Madison. Oh. Yeah, not to the university.
Yes.
Well, but he wants to take up teaching or something?
No, he's got something else in mind.
Oh, he's got something else in mind. He wants to resume his relationship. I knew he was coming back to Madison, but I didn't know.
Well, that's what he says.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thinks he should be president.
President of what?
Oh, but we've got a president, haven't we?
That's right.
President of the system.
What? Yes.
Everybody?
No.
I think you could find a couple of demurers in Eau Claire.
If you polled around the state at the other institutions, I don't think you'd find much assent.
But it might. But he's over age. He'll be over age, you see, so that question won't come up.
Yeah.
You know, the other day when you said that you gave some money to some of the other institutions in the system because they were, was this when you were chancellor?
It matters.
Yeah.
Well, I agreed to it.
You agreed to it.
And supported the idea of bailing out. And it's a loan. Yeah. It was a loan.
Well, did it ever get paid back?
I think so.
Well, because one of the grievances expressed by people in Madison is that the allocations were not coming into Madison according to its enrollment, but were going to shore up other...
Well, that went up for 1 year to shore up.
1 year, yeah.
And we got the money back.
You don't think that ever happened? At any other time?
Well, there was another time when when Madison was overfunded for the enrollment that they had.
Well, see, the whole system was underfunded for years.
Yeah.
No, but I mean Madison for its enrollment compared. For instance, I saw a letter from the superior man to the board saying, "Superiors, us little colleges ought to get more funding." Mm. Because we're needed where we are, mm-hmm. which would mean it would have to come out of some place.
Yeah, but it didn't.
Presumably.
It didn't.
It didn't.
No. I think that now some people, a lot of people in Madison, including Irv Shane at one stage when he was chancellor, said there was an unfair allocation. I looked into it very closely. Ruben Lorenz was doing it, and he is the fairest, most honest person you'll ever see, and he wouldn't do anything that was improper and allocating funds. If we changed the allocation, I would have known about it, and I, as chancellor, I agreed. It was that Whitewater, I think it was in terrible trouble, and were we going to let them go down? I bought more goodwill from Madison with that money that we could get along without for a year, and then we got it back. Mm-hmm. It was the only thing to do. It was good politics as well as.
Why is this notion so fixed?
Because everybody's underfunded.
Somebody starts some rumor like that, and pretty soon it's a fact.
They had no way of finding out, would they?
Yeah. Oh, they all they have to do is ask me, and I'll tell them, or they can go check the books.
They would have a way of finding out, but they don't. But
that spoils the fun.
It's much more entertaining.
One of the interesting things about academic life is that the greatest scientists are are the least scientific about the way they carry on their own business, the university. They don't apply any science to their education or anything they do in the university. They run it all by gossip and innuendo. They don't all. But seriously, the faculty does rally around when it's needed. But the misinformation around is very great. I think if you went over to the French department and interviewed the faculty about what's happening in the university, they don't know, and they got it confused with some French university that they attended in their youth, and they still think it's the same place.
Somebody always has a villain, and the villain is for their own distress, and the villain is usually, depending on what level you are, the next level that's closest at hand, or the one that's most politic. And they don't, the budget process is extraordinarily complex. It's a huge amount of data, and they don't want to take the trouble of puzzling that out. So you can find, I can find people in my department who believe there is money that we're not getting our fair share in L&S. Well, I think we're getting as much money as
you deserve.
Maybe not as much as we deserve, but as much as Cronin can find, you know. Yeah. And that he's not rolling in money. And then if you go to L&S people, or you go over to the business school, they think it's because the chancellor's giving too much money to L&S and engineering. That's why the business school is underfunded.
Now, all the time I was dean and chancellor, my department, economics, knew that they were not getting their fair share. There was a little truth in it. They wanted, I wouldn't prove they're getting what they asked for. What they were asking for was enough money to provide tenure positions for all the teaching, and half of them were on leave expecting to come back at any time when they leave. And there was no way we're going to take that risk.
Yeah.
So you have to, there's things like that which, you know, they, when you talk to them, they agree, but they really would rather go out and say you're not, you're being unfair.
Except that in the case of Madison, there's the enrollment funding formula, and you should be able to figure out fairly accurately, you know, what the enrollment is, and you know.
What they're complaining about, a lot of them, is the fact that in any given year, the formula is not automatic, and I was the one that invented that because I don't think it should be. And
so it's a non-formula.
Well,
no, it is
a formula, but it was always a give-back situation. You're going to be protected, and we had a corridor. We said we'll protect you for 3 years, one-third, one-third, one-third. I had Milwaukee was overfunded by if you go down to Milwaukee and ask the faculty, they'd always said they were being gypped.
You say they're overfunded. Well, who was being underfunded then?
Well,
because of the shifts, you see.
The
somebody
shifts,
else
yeah.
had grown, and they hadn't shrunk in proportion to their budget. But you can't make that change just overnight like that.
You can't say in 1 year, if you happen to fall $1 million short, we're going to take $1 million out of your budget unless you're a very bad administrator. Mm. And but then you protect this budget this year, and 3 years from then, it may be the budget that's underfunded, or is going to have to do a little protecting of somebody else. Ed would, Ed was always very cooperative on that. He understood it.
Well, you can't have a tenure system and then change the budget that fast. You can't fire people. The law won't let us. You know, if we wanted to, we have to give them years to prove that they're needed.
But if that still could be that. That still bears out the possibility that Madison could be underfunded just because you had to protect somebody.
In 1 year.
But some year when we were overfunded, you see? No, we were treated fairly. There just wasn't enough money to go around.
Well, you're still saying we, anyway.
Yeah.
When it has the impression sometimes people get co-opted by it.
What?
The system, and what you might have said they.
Oh, no.
Well, when I say we, I mean Madison.
Yes, I know. That's what I mean.
Yes. No.